Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A reminder again that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, on iTunes, on Stitcher. And this might be a good idea. This week alone, we started off by talking with Benjamin Wittes about the Mueller report. Benjamin Wittes, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare. Then we talked with Jonah Goldberg. We talked about Game of Thrones, Veep, and his new magazine effort with Steve Hayes. And then yesterday we talked with Natasha Bertrand, who has been writing for The Atlantic and is now at Politico, who went through what you might have missed in the Mueller report. And just a hint coming up a little bit later this week, we'll be talking with Princeton professor Julian Zelizer. And today we are joined by Rick Wilson, the author of Everything Trump Touches Dies, which sort of sums up everything. Good to be with you again, Rick.
Thank you, Charlie. Glad to be with you.
I just kind of had a feeling that everything everybody touches turns to bleep today. I mean, where do we start? I just was making a list of things that I wanted to talk to you about, including, you know, Donald Trump. In the midst of one of his rage tweets, he's clearly, for a guy who's exonerated, I mean, he seems pretty pissed off on Twitter. He meets with Jack, the CEO of Twitter, in the Oval Office. And there's that picture of Jack sitting there across from the desk being ranted at by the president. And I got to say, this didn't strike me as one of the great moments in social media.
You know, I think we all swim in the ecosystem of Twitter's warm and delicious waters. But, you know, Donald Trump's ability to corrupt anyone and to absolutely corrupt naive people is one that I'm very concerned about, because, you know, no matter how that meeting went, no matter what Jack thought he was accomplishing, what Donald Trump was accomplishing was to give himself the ability to continue to play the victim, to play the whiner, to continue to say, oh, they're so mean to me. They don't let me have all of my bot followers. Oh, this is so awful. You know, this constant whine of complaint about how he is not treated properly. It's definitional to Trump and Trumpism. But it is one of those things where people, like, I know how irresistible a White House meeting is. I know how people say, oh, I can't turn down a meeting with the president of the leader of the free world. And it will never end like people who go into those meetings think they will end.
I
think Jack is now, you know, I think they put some shareholder value on the line by meeting with this guy, because nothing they do will satisfy him ever. There's no you cannot abase yourself enough to make Donald Trump like you or to behave like a normal human being.
No, was it you who came up with a formulation that with the other Donald Trump, there's only two choices, defiance or cowering at his feet, and it doesn't really matter. Okay, let's just go through some of the news of the day. Boy genius Jared Kushner offers, you look at what Russia did, buying some Facebook ads and trying to sow dissent. It's a terrible thing. This is at a Time magazine event in New York. He said this. It's a terrible thing. But I think the investigations and all of the speculation that's happened for the last 2 years has a much harsher impact on our democracy than a couple of Facebook ads. So that's inside the White House. No big deal.
Considering Jared is a guy who wouldn't know ethics if they bit him on the ass, I found that statement to be, you know, somewhat egregious, but not as egregious, frankly. You know, this is a guy who is best pals with the person who ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't expect Jared to, like, step up and be a paragon of moral virtue. But, you know, it is disappointing to see the nepotist son-in-law of the president of the United States and secretary of everything basically getting away with that.
Yeah, and this is not just a gaffe. This actually has consequences. And, you know, the New York Times report today, and I know you saw this, it's got a triple byline, and push for 2020 election security top official has warned, don't tell Trump. In the months before Kirstjen Nielsen was forced to resign, she tried to focus the White House on one of her highest priorities as Homeland Security Secretary, preparing for new and different Russian forms of interference in the 2020 election. President Trump's chief of staff told her not to bring it up in front of the president because Mick Mulvaney made it clear that Trump still equated any public discussion of malign Russian election activity with questions about the legitimacy of his victory. According to one senior administration official, Mulvaney said it wasn't a great subject and should be kept below his level. Whoa. See, of all the things we kind of passed over in the Mueller report, the unchallenged documentation of the fact that the Russians were attacking the election and intend to continue to attack the election. So leaving aside all of the other Trump stuff, the question is, what are we going to do about it? And we have a president who is not only indifferent to the ongoing Russian attacks, but apparently His aides, they don't even talk to him about it. Oh, you know, man, Charlie, we are so screwed.
This morning I tweeted a sort of mocking fake Trump quote, but then I realized, oh my God, this is exactly what he would say. And it was what's wrong with that? Putin likes me, so what? And I honestly believe that's what they think, is that this is okay because, quote unquote, Putin likes him. And that's the metric of Donald Trump. That's the standard of Donald Trump, is if someone, quote unquote, likes him, they're good and everyone else is evil. We're going to have an impact on this where foreign adversaries will look at this as a nod and a wink, and they'll say, well, I guess we're free to do what we want to do. And Trump's all in. Trump's on board for us. And it is. I'd like to say it's shocking, Charlie, but at this point, I mean, how can anybody be shocked by, you know, the behavior that we're seeing here?
Yeah, this no, we're
unsurprising in every dimension.
Okay, now you know more about Larry Johnson than I do. The president apparently has been watching that the One America Network, which actually makes Fox seem normal and unbiased. It's kind of a conspiracy theory network, and they have this guy Larry Johnson on, and who's suggesting that that the British were the Obama administration got the Brits to spy on the Trump campaign, and the president of the United States is tweeting this out. He's clearly been watching this One America Network, and so, but from what I can tell,
I don't know Larry Johnson personally.
Right,
Larry Johnson is a guy who was fired from the CIA back in the 90s, and he's always been on sort of the edges of these conspiracy theory things. And at one point in the 2000, I think it was in the 08 campaign. I've got to go back and look through my old records. At one point, he was trying to sell one of my researchers a supposed lead on a tape of Michelle Obama talking about, oh, we have to put down Whitey. And that was his claim to fame, that he supposedly had this smoking gun tape of evidence that the Obamas were radical, you know, black activists or some hoo-ha. You know, and as a guy who has been known to, you know, be fairly stern about Barack Obama as a candidate and as a president, you know, even I was like, I don't even care if this is real, because it's not real and it's bullshit. And this guy is a kook, and he's absolutely a nut job. So at best, he's a nut job, but I think he's basically just a scammer.
Yeah, but so, apparently he's got the president of the United States now tweeting all of this stuff out. Speaking of which, one of the things in the Mueller report that did not come as breaking news to me, but which certainly documented in great detail the fact that Seth Rich had nothing to do with the WikiLeaks leaks, and that this was a coordinated, really vicious, evil smear of this dead young man, and yet, of course, we know how people like Sean Hannity and others, very prominent Republicans, allow themselves to be part of all of that and push all of that. And, you know, I know it's like spitting into the wind to say, you know, is there going to be a reckoning? How does Sean Hannity's reputation, such as it is, survive his involvement in what was clearly just one of the ugliest episodes in American political hoaxes? That assumes we have any standards of shame at all for anyone.
Right. It wasn't just Sean Hannity. It was Sean Hannity, and it was Rush, and it was all these bottom feeders as well.
Newt Gingrich.
Who are the climbers in the Trump world, the Mike Cernoviches and the Jack Posobiecs and all these other cat and dog types who were, you know, saying that the Awan brothers were the assassins used by Hillary to kill Seth Rich. And, you know, and it was just it's insanity. And it is, I mean, look, if Fox was an actual news network, they would never have survived in that position. But we know what they are now. And it's something where you know, they will memory hole the Seth Rich story as much as they can. They will always go back to but her emails. And they will always pretend that there's not a proximate network between the Trumpist supposedly conservative media and this gigantic ocean of conspiracy theory lunacy that is the Seth Rich and QAnon and Pizzagate and all this other crap. And you know, anytime now the mass arrests are coming, but it is a repulsive part of the ecosystem right now that will not go away. Because Trump feeds it, and because Trump's people feed it, and you know, if you're ever wondering like where does QAnon get these pictures, it's because Dan Scavino is feeding them these pictures. It's because these people are they know the conspiracy theory shit feeds the base of the Trump Party, because conspiracy theories give people who are not educated or intellectually curious a place to have a cohesive vision of what they think is really going on. And Trump knows that. He knows that the attention span of his base is very shallow and narrow. And so they use these conspiracies to feed them all the time. And then Seth Rich is a particularly egregious example of that.
So let's talk about the whole question of impeachment and the way the Democrats are handling it. I wrote a piece yesterday basically saying, you know, should they do it? You know, definitely, maybe. I you know, bottom line, I actually think, and I'm kind of surprised to hear myself say this, I actually think that Nancy Pelosi is handling this in a rather prudent manner, which is to don't rush into the impeachment itself, but continue to build the case with the public. You can have all of these hearings, you can have all of this investigation, all of this oversight, but once you basically pull the pin on a hand grenade of impeachment, it changes the political dynamic in a way that's very, very risky. Right.
Correct. And this is what I've said from the start of this, is even if the Mueller report had produced a video of Donald Trump taking a sack of cash from Vladimir Putin, it doesn't change the way that Trump's dynamic works with his base. And so you've got to get people, you know, a clearer understanding. Why did Trump's approval rating drop 5 points this week? Mm-hmm. Because the general public is not spending every day worrying about Russia. And they weren't during this whole process. The general public is not Twitter. When they thought about it for even 5 minutes, even though Trump is quote unquote totally exonerated and totally cool, when they thought about it and heard about it, they were like, this is not good.
Yeah.
This is not what we want our president to be doing. And so, you know, we end up in a situation where Nancy Pelosi can either make this into a year of slow burn, death of a thousand cuts, drag them and tag them, bring them into, you know, testify over and over again and beat them down to the point where this becomes the only public definitional characteristic of Trump's administration, or you can go for a one-off, you know, run and gun and try to get the impeachment thing to happen. And if it doesn't happen, you've lost and Trump is inoculated. If it does happen, it's not going to pass the Senate. Trump then laughs and says, fuck you, nobody else was impeached. Ha ha, I survived it, no one else could. I mean, it's just a bad bet, and it's a juvenile bet. And that's why, you know, AOC and all these other freshmen want to do it, because they don't know how it works, and they really want to hustle through, you know, the thing that satisfies their little ego space here, and not what gets the job done of removing Trump from office.
You know, Joe Lockhart, who was the press secretary under Bill Clinton, wrote a piece in the New York Times basically saying that, look, you could overplay your hand here and nothing would really rally the conservative base as much as impeachment. Of course, on the other hand, you know, if in fact it's true that the president cannot be indicted, because of the Department of Justice rules, and if Congress does not exercise its impeachment authority, then the president literally becomes above the law. So I do think there's that balancing act. They have to hold him accountable. They have to bring, you know, Bob Mueller in front of, you know, Congress. They have to have these televised hearings. But, you know, you mentioned about this poll, the poll numbers dropping by 5 points. I tried to make the point the other day that, you know, you don't need to have half of the Fox audience break bad on Donald Trump. If he has an erosion of 3 or 4 points from his approval rating. That's fatal for him. And given how small his base is, now you're a political consultant, so you know this a little bit more. The difference between your reelect percentage, the likelihood of being reelected, if you're at 43 versus say 38, is dramatic. It is the difference between another 4 years and Trump possibly being blown out. That's why I do think kind of the two track approach seems to be the most prudent, which is keep building this case as much as you possibly can, and you know, see whether or not the public needle is moved. But I think they need to be aggressively doing that, because otherwise, if they kind of just say, well, let's move on to other things, then in fact they've normalized Donald Trump, and then the public will reasonably come to the conclusion there's nothing to see here.
Well, I think the problem is that impeachment relied on an ancient sort of system where men of honor who were caught doing something horrible, and the founders, when they engineered the impeachment process into the Constitution, they knew that their worry was that the leader of the United States would be compromised in some way in the pocket of a foreign power or engaged in behavior that was so antithetical to the office that they would have to be removed, and they thought that that person would have such a sense of shame that they would leave because they had been impeached. Donald Trump will not do – there will be no modification of his behavior. He is already above the law de facto.
Yeah.
And there will be no modification of his behavior by impeaching him. And even if the Senate convicted him, I don't think the guy would leave office without a fight.
Yeah. Well, that's moot, because the Senate is never going to impeach him. I mean, a Senate full of Lindsey Grahams, I mean oh, right. My God. So now I want to get into a more difficult part of this conversation, because, you know, the Democrats are trying to figure out, OK, do we run on impeachment or not on impeachment, or do we want to run on all these other wonderful issues we have? And you and I have discussed this before. You know, I've written How the Right Has Lost Its Mind. You've written Everything Trump Touches Dies. It really feels to me as if the Democrats and the left are in the process of losing their minds, and everything they are touching is turning to whatever. I mean, whether it's doubling down on free college and daycare, whether or not like Bernie suggesting that prisoners can vote. The obsession with reparations, that's a political winner.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Convincing themselves somehow that nationalized health care, the massive taxes, the abolition of private insurance, cutting the pay of health industry workers, that somehow that we've moved the Overton window, that all of that is acceptable. And the very real possibility the Democrats will nominate a self-described democratic socialist. It's really remarable watching what they're doing to themselves.
Charlie, you couldn't be more correct. And I'm getting a ton of crap online today, in fact, because the Bernie bros are out in force on me, because I've said it. I've said this a dozen times. Bernie Sanders is Trump reelection insurance. Mm-hmm. He is commie Mondale. He will go so far out there that Donald Trump will win 45 states. He will win everything except the coastals, and he will crush them like a bug. And it won't be because Donald Trump is a good dude or a great candidate. It's because Bernie Sanders is an 80-year-old guy who comes across as exactly what he is, a commie from Vermont. And that is not the flavor Americans are looking for at the end of the day. And he may be the all-time champion of promising free shit, but Donald Trump will turn him – and the thing about people that Bernie people don't understand is that Donald Trump is an idiot and a buffoon and a fool and everything else. But he is now surrounded by a bunch of Republican operatives and ad makers and strategists and message people who are very good at this business. Donald Trump wakes up every morning with a Woody, hoping it's Bernie Sanders he runs against. Every morning. He would love that. He would eat that up with a damn spoon. Because he knows that Bernie is so far out there that he can be so easily caricatured as being so crazy that this race, the script of this race writes itself. And if I was still in the business of doing this, I would be laughing my ass off every day praying it was Bernie Sanders.
You know what's interesting is you watch the same things that I watch, though, is the folks on the progressive left are convincing themselves that this is the opportunity to go bold, and they have to have bold ideas by which it's almost always a massive new spending plan, massive new tax increases, massive dislocation of the economy. And in within their bubbles, I mean, if you're talking about this on the Chris Hayes show, you know, everybody's nodding their head, and you can have polls showing that people are reasonably okay with this. But in the heat of a campaign, when people begin to give people information about all of this, do you really want to raise taxes by $31 trillion? Do you really want to abolish your private insurance? You want to take away things that people have? Do you really want to have the Boston Marathon bomber be able to vote? Are we really going to have a candidate who is suggesting a plan for reparations? We, by the way, posted a piece on the Bulwark, taking reparations seriously. And, and as much as I like having a diversity of point of views, the reality is that reparations are not a serious idea. Nobody knows how they would work. And politically, they're about as toxic as you could possibly get. And I feel I'm only like halfway down the list of ideas that are absolutely radioactive in the course of a campaign.
I will say this until I'm blue in the face, because Democrats are still thinking that they're in a political environment. They are in a reality television show. The reality television show, their opponent is the master of the genre. No matter what they propose, he will turn it into something that is caricatured and twisted and distorted. No matter what they think the merits of their arguments are, they will not be merits for five more minutes than it takes for the tweeter-in-chief to mobilize his people to caricature these things. This is a referendum on Donald Trump or nothing. Unless this is a referendum on Trump and they're prepared to make it a referendum on Trump, they will lose. They will, if they nominate Bernie, they will lose 45 states.
Well, this seems to be something that Trump understands. He does not want it to be a referendum on him. He wants it to be a choice. And I think that the Trump people are very, very comfortable with the binary choice that, you know, Hillary was awful, but whoever the Democrats nominate will be Hillary 2.0. And, you know, no matter how awful Trump is, you know, he's counting on a lot of those suburban voters who came out in 2018 and voted for Democrats to go into the voting booth and say, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, but I am not voting for Bernie Sanders. I'm not voting to blow up my 401k. I'm not voting for the federal government to come in and reset the economy based on the Green New Deal. But does this apply to other candidates as well? I mean, you focused on Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren is basically Bernie Sanders with more white papers and slightly less cranky. But her policies really would play in the same way, wouldn't they? Or do you have a different take on her?
I think Warren comes across as more professorial and less kooky. So I think she's got a little more runway, even though I disagree with her ideas in large degree. Bernie's are sort of more amorphous and more ill-defined in terms of the nuts and bolts of the policy decisions that – whereas she has got on April 15th, our plan will execute, line 417 of page 42, of the Warren Economic Realignment System. So I think she's got a lot more granularity, and that, that may give her a little more runway than Bernie. But look, I come down to this a lot, and I've said this a million times, that the Democratic base has a particular set of flavors they like. And one of the reasons I think Bernie is a surefire loser is Bernie does not do well with African Americans.
Yes, he does not.
Bernie does not do well with women. And I'm sorry, if those two groups, if you didn't pay attention to 2018, those two groups were the backbone of the Democrats picking up 40 seats in the House of Representatives. And they were the backbone of Democrats picking up 365 seats across the country below the congressional level. And if you've got a candidate at the top of the ticket who African Americans shrug their shoulders and go, eh, and look, I mean, Hillary Clinton's model, okay, was built around the premise that she would get Obama levels of African American turnout, which was crazy.
Yeah.
But compared to Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton is practically an African American candidate. I mean, he is the whitest white dude of all white dudes. It's also one of the ironies, I think you've probably observed this too, Charlie. for the Democrats who all the time scream that they've had enough of old white men telling them what to do.
Yeah, I know. Right.
They sure love Bernie Sanders.
It is odd, and this is I tend to be much more sympathetic, for example, to Joe Biden. But I'm sure I've said this on this podcast several times. It is amazing to me, given the current political environment and what's going on in the Democratic Party, to realize that you have two 70-year-old white guys who are leading the pack. So where do you come down on Mayor Pete Buttigieg? You know, he's so fascinating, but I think with Bill Kristol and I were talking about this the other day, and you know, if there's a beer lane in Democratic politics and there's a wine lane, he's kind of in the champagne lane right now.
He's kind of in the delightful bespoke cocktail lane, I think.
Yes. Okay.
You know, he's got this flavor about him that is intriguing, and it's been mixed behind the bar by a bartender with a lot of piercings and tats, but who's also wearing a old-timey vest. And, you know, it's very Portlandia. So I like the way that he has managed to get into the media headspace here in this race. I think he's very agile. I think he's very, very smart. That really counts in debates and in presentation stuff. And especially in a crowded field where, you know, a mayor of a small town in the Midwest would ordinarily not even be in the ballpark of being able to do the, you know, to do a lift like this. I mean, he should be a Tulsi Gabbard at 1%.
Yeah, but he's not.
No. But he's not. He's got hustle and he's got brains and he's very articulate. And don't underestimate the fact that media people like Pete because he reminds them of who they like to be.
Yeah.
You know, articulate, super educated, very, very, you know, very, very quick on his feet, very witty. And so I think there's something there that he's certainly riding, you know, a pretty serious wave right now.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think how, though, that lane gets him to victory. When you have Biden rolling out with this rather strong, you know, labor union backing,
sure.
Bernie's got the Bernie bros. Kamala Harris, I think, is going to appeal very strongly to African Americans. Yep. So in terms of the constituency, you know, outside of, you know, Portlandia, where is really the coalition for
that Americans? Really is the question. I mean, and I'm old enough to remember that the Democrats back in the dawn of time fell in love with Paul Tsongas.
Yep.
Exactly. Who had the same sort of like super brilliant nerd affect, and everyone thought Paul Tsongas was the future and the relief of this whole thing.
Bill Bradley was like that too.
And Bill Bradley was like that too. Sure, absolutely. And so I'm just not, you know, I'm not. It's very early in the process. We're still at the beginning of the beginning, not the beginning of the end on the Democratic nominating process. But look, he's bought himself a position in this race by hustle and brains and raising money. Yeah. You know, I think, and in some ways, he proved that the brains have to go with the cool affect. I mean, Beto has all this cool affect, but there's not as much there, I think, as some folks on the Democratic side had hoped. He doesn't seem to be breaking through the way Pete is.
No, it's interesting. It is like Pete has shoved aside Beto. You know, Beto had that lane, that cool kid, smart kid lane, and he can't really compete at this point. So, what do you think? Let's switch over to the Democratic side. Bill Weld and Larry Hogan.
Well, look, I like Bill Weld. I've known Bill a long time. And he was a great governor in Massachusetts. And he is a man, interestingly, if you go back historically, who during the Reagan administration, when Ed Meese was doing some things, you know, that back then were scandalous, but, you know, by the Bill Barr standard or nothing, you know, he and a couple of other folks stood up and said, no, we're leaving the administration. We can't be a party to things that aren't ethical and legal. And Bill is a Republican of a school that I proudly still consider myself a part of, but that I proudly, you know, or that I grimly admit is no longer the fashion. He's not a populist. He is not a yeller. He's not a loudmouth.
Yeah.
He's not part of the sort of Trumpian era of you know, fuck you politics and pwn the libs as the centerpiece of all things Republican. So, you know, I think he's got a case he's going to make. He's got a theory of that case to go out there into the world and try to maintain a presence and visibility in New England and in California, Oregon, and Washington, where Trump, even among Republicans, is a little squishy. It's a long, long million to one shot, but I'm glad he's doing it. Larry Hogan, I think highly of Larry. He is a great governor. He has done an amazing job in Maryland. He seems to be putting his toe back in the water again. And I think it's, you know, look, I think that anything that gives Republicans a scintilla of hope that some people in our party are still willing to stand up and fight is meritorious, even if it's ultimately doomed.
Yeah, and Bill Weld is actually surprising me by the vigor of his campaign. He has a piece at the Bulwark yesterday where
it was
an essay calling on the president to resign. Okay, so this coming Sunday, and I'm sure you've had a chance to look at it, New York Times Magazine has a long piece by Mark Leibovich about our little band of Never Trump Republicans. Let me read you the key paragraph, which I'm sure has already memorized it.
Yeah.
The diehard remnant population of Never Trumpers comes most visibly from the class of Republican consultants, conservative media personalities, and a few GOP office holders safely removed from the considerations of reelection campaigns. The best-known never-Trumpers have seen their profile soar in disproportion to their actual influence among Republicans. Still, quote, there is merit in maintaining a rebel army. The Republican strategist Rick Wilson told me there is a moral case to be made for standing up for non-authoritarian conservatism. No kidding. There is, and here's the next line from Leibovich's piece, there is also money to be made. Wilson's anti-Trump manifesto, Everything Trump Touches Dies, became an instant New York Times instant number one New York Times bestseller in 2018, and now he has a constant cable TV presence. He has another book on the way, lucrative speaking gigs coming in, and magazine assignments, and inevitably you'll have a podcast too, right? Though, he says, it has not offset the $4.5 million in income he estimates he has lost in recent years from would-be clients. And now, because you and I are bookended here, despite this heightened media presence, waging what has become a shrinking insurgency can exact a psychic toil. Quote, I'm not going to pretend that I'm not disappointed that we've had this attrition, said Charlie Sykes, a conservative former radio host in Wisconsin whose umbrage over Trump has gained him cable ubiquity. I think I'm on like once this week. And a book of his own, How the Right Lost Its Mind. It's been this rolling, soul-crushing disappointment watching people that you thought you knew. But this, he added, has only strengthened his conviction. It's really not that hard a choice, he said. There are advantages to being an only child. So let's talk about this, Rick, because this has been grinding my gears from the beginning. I don't know about your business model, but you know, I do have a contract with MSNBC that is literally an 80% pay cut from what I used to make as a conservative radio talk show host in Milwaukee. So when I read this, oh, you've gone where the money is, in terms of, you know, my world, I am an only child, but the sense that you know, we Never Trumpers are cashing in is like, I'm sorry, I am sick of that bullshit, you know?
You know, Charlie, let me tell you, I am honored by the reception of my book. I have talked to more people than I think I've ever talked to in my life. I have people tell me all the time, thank you for writing this. You made me laugh. You made me think. I'm honored by the amazing reviews. I could not tell you how happy I am with the way my book was received. And I was delighted with how well it did in terms of sales and in terms of, you know, being a number one bestseller and in terms of reaching out to a lot of people. And a lot of great things have come from that. No question about it. Wouldn't change it for a second. But the idea that we're on television, on cable, and writing books and giving speeches because it's where the money is fucking ludicrous. This is an example in part of the fact that these are not people who were ever in professional politics in their lives, and they're still not. They still think Trumpism is you know, they think they've just seized the means of production here. But the the pay cut I've taken in this on moral principle, and I'm not singing some sad song. I've done very well in my life. I'm just fine. But the pay cut level for me is also in the 80% range. And that's including a New York Times number one bestseller.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So these people are out of their damn minds, because being a political media consultant is a damn good gig. And it was a damn good gig that I was damn good at. But I do not regret it. I wake up every morning ready to fight. I wake up every morning feeling like I am on the right side of history and that I'm doing the right thing. And that I'm going to get up every day and I'm going to keep putting one foot in front of the other, no matter how many days I go, fuck, I could have had a private jet by now. You know, it's a ridiculous assertion on their part, but it also speaks to who these people are. It speaks to this conspiratorial idea that George Soros is cutting us huge checks every month so we can defy the president's will. It speaks to this idea that big media is like paying us off to be anti-Trump. You know, I'd be anti-Trump if I was having to camp out behind the Walmart in a tent.
And also, there's so much projection because, you know, the reality is that much of what's happened in the Republican Party and among professional conservatives has been very specifically that people have decided to make their peace, to rationalize, to enable Trump, because that is their business model. Because if they want to continue to get their position, right, want to get ratings, want to get clicks, want to continue to be, part of conservative Inc., you have to. And so one of the reasons why our number is so tiny is because there are not only the financial sacrifices, but the reality is we are no longer part of a family and a tribe that we're part of. And I'm sitting here in my office here in Mequon, Wisconsin, and I'm looking at pictures all over my walls. And the number of people that I'm no longer associated with, maybe not even on speaking terms with, is like it's a little bit depressing. And again, I'm not playing the victim card, because I share with you, it's been a great honor to be out there in a fight that I really believe in.
Yeah.
And I've associated with new folks that I would never probably would have encountered before. And yet, it is not a small thing to turn the page on 20, 30, 40 years of your life and realize how much of a personal, and again, this seems to be discounted. I mean, we're talking in terms of money, but it's great to have a 5-minute hit on a cable show, but does that actually compensate for the fact that your entire political, cultural, social, environment has been napalmed?
And the worst of the ones, Charlie, and both in my personal and professional life, that the worst of the people were folks who I wasn't just political acquaintances or buddies or allies with. The worst of them were folks that we consider ourselves friends for a long time, and who say, "I still love you. You're still a close friend. I still care about you, but I can't be seen talking to you. I can't be seen associating with you. I can't retweet you. I can't come to your parties. I can't have dinner with you."
Yeah.
And it's because I'm afraid. And it makes me sad. I look at these people and I'm like, you don't have the guts and the balls to stand up for your friends and still defend them. You know, no matter what, you're that afraid. This world makes you that afraid. Trump makes you that scared every day. And it's a terrifying perspective, I think, on a lot of folks, in the political and media space, just how craven they are and just how afraid they are. I mean, I had a phone call this morning, and actually made me kind of really happy. And this is a guy who I've known for a long time. I helped him in one of his first campaigns, and he's about to retire from Congress. He hasn't even announced it yet. And he called me this morning. He goes, "I have to apologize to you." I'm like, "What's up?"
Mm-hmm.
He goes, "You know, 2 years ago, I cut you off at the knees and basically, essentially told a bunch of people, 'Fuck Rick, Trump's going to be the way we go.'" And he goes, "And I have spent every day of the last 2 years miserable and angry at myself and afraid." And he goes, I don't know when I'm going to get my balls back, but he goes, "I just want to say I'm out. I'm done." He said, "I'm going to figure out when I go public on it." And this is a person who's, I would say, is a 6 or 7 of 10 on the pro-Trump scale in Congress, but he has certainly been front and center on a number of these things, you know, basically saying Donald Trump's shit doesn't stink, and he, and every morning he wakes up and pisses a river of rainbows. So, you know, they're out there, but the fear factor in most of them is what's really disappointing. The ones that are just, you know, like fuck it, it's my business, bro. I got to pay the mortgage. I get it. I understand it.
No, I get the transactional stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but most of them that, you know, and some of them are very transparent. Some of them are very much, you know, look, there's a major social media and digital firm that was completely anti-Trump. They were Marco, they were Jeb, they were completely not Trumpers, and now they could not be more red hat because, you know, they basically bent the knee and went to the RNC and said, oh, please keep us. So, you know, but then again, the disloyalty inside the Trump world and the grift and the scamming inside Trump world. I know another Republican consultant who has spent 2 years sucking up to Trump, begging for forgiveness. Please let me in. And the guy has lost his firm because the Trump people strung him along for 2 years and said, keep kissing his ass, keep doing things for free for us, keep telling us that, you know, your never Trump friends are all assholes. And guess what? The guy's going out of business because the Trump people fucked him because they're evil. So, you know,
well,
like I said,
give people the pressure. So Bill Barr.
Yes,
I'm a little bit obsessed about this because there's a whole group of Washington folks who were absolutely convinced he needed to give Bill Barr the benefit of the doubt because he wouldn't. I mean, he's a former attorney general. Yeah. He's a successful lawyer, but doesn't he represent exactly what you're describing here? Just somebody who this willingness to blow up your own reputation, to just trash your own legacy, to be part of all of this. And I know you talk about this in your book, but this just seems like another example of both the pressure and the allure of being a Trump sycophant these days.
It really is. And the idea that David Frum articulated, I think, was so on point. He said there is something about Trump. He finds a crack in your moral armor. And once you're in a room with him, he destroys you. He has this hypnotic power over these people who believe that they're the exception to the Trump rule, that they're the one who will have the ability to change the way Trump behaves, or they're the ones who will profit from it. And it never works. It's never there. But he is a great con artist and a great salesman, and he does this to people over and over again. And I think Bill Barr is one of the great mysteries of our time because he had been attorney general. He had peaked out. He was the top of the DC food chain lawyer-wise. And was secure.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's something that happened that we'll probably never understand or know, but there is something that happened to Bill Barr where he sat in a room with Donald Trump and said, I will sacrifice every shred of my reputation, my integrity, my history for you. I was one of those people giving him a chance, Charlie. I was in the first Bush administration, the 41 administration, as a very, very, very junior guy, right out of school, working for Cheney at the Pentagon, had a great job, loved it, but I didn't know the attorney general. I wasn't buddies with Bill Barr, but I met him literally like a handshake one time at a Christmas party. But I talked to people that I knew would know him, you know, the gray beards of the Bush 41 administration that I still talk to, and every single one of them, to a man, was like, oh, he is a solid guy. Not worry. Bill Barr, this has got to be a trick. Bill Barr is an institutionalist. He's a dignified person. He would never compromise the DOJ. He would never compromise the office of AG. Bump, bada, bump, bada, bump. Well, turns out, couldn't have been more wrong. Because he is, Bill Barr's reputation is gone. It is shattered. And so if the bet he's made is that Trumpism is the permanent new state of Washington, then, you know, welcome to Supreme Court Justice Bill Barr. But if the political equilibrium in D.C. doesn't maintain, you know, 1,000% Trumpism, it's going to be the guy's going to go down with a permanent mark on his record. He's going to be, you know, shamed throughout history.
You undoubtedly have noticed the number of times your book's title has been invoked describing or discussing Bill Barr.
I have indeed.
You know, once you establish all of that.
And one more thing. The crazy thing is, if Bill Barr ever does find a moment where he has to oppose Trump, all of the things he's done to help Trump will be thrown out the window. He will be the enemy of the people right away.
Oh, instantaneously.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's one of the fascinating things to watch is Trumpian Twitter, how quickly it will change direction. I mean, it's like watching one of those videos of flock of birds heading in one direction and then they just immediately go in the other direction. Yep. And it's like, wow, that's really, you know, it's like the bat signal is out there and they're not all bots. Rick Wilson, thanks so much for spending
so much time with me. I'll see you soon.
I appreciate we'll see you soon. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.